You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here this evening. My name is Fawzia Naqvi, and I represent the Soros Economic Development Fund. On behalf of the Open Society Foundation, Soros Economic Development Fund, and Revenue Watch Institute, it is my pleasure to welcome you here this evening for what promises to be an enlightening discussion on new ways of thinking about poverty eradication in resource-rich countries and the implementation of direct dividend payments generated from mineral wealth to the vast majority of citizens who are poor. Our focus tonight will be on the Africa region and whether direct cash transfers to Africa citizens is a solution for poverty eradication and a more equitable share and benefit from the region's mineral wealth, and how this may actually have a global implication as well. For this discussion and the questions it raises, I am very pleased to have with us tonight our main speaker, Marcelo Giogale of the World Bank, and discussant Alexandra Gillies, and who is my colleague from Revenue Watch Institute. I welcome you both here this evening. Now allow me to present their bios for you, which are both very illustrious. Marcelo is the World Bank's Director of Economic Policy and Poverty Reduction Programs for Africa. An international development leader, his more than 25 years of experience span the Middle East, Eastern Europe, Central Asia, Latin America, and Africa, where he led senior-level policy dialogue and over $25 billion in lending operations across the development spectrum. He has published widely on economic policy, finance, development economics, business, agriculture, and applied econometrics. You've been very busy, Marcelo.
Indeed.
Notably, he was the chief editor of collections of policy notes published for the presidential transitions in Mexico, Colombia, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Peru. His opinion editorials are published in the leading newspapers and blog sites of Africa, Latin America, and the U.S. He received decorations from the government of Bolivia and Peru and taught at the American University in Cairo, the London School of Economics, and the Universidad Católica Argentina. A citizen of Argentina and Italy, he holds a PhD and MSc in economics from the London School of Economics and a summa cum laude BA in economics from Universidad Católica Argentina. Alexandra is the head of governance programs at the Revenue Watch Institute, a nonprofit policy institute that promotes the effective, transparent, and accountable management of oil, gas, and mineral resources. Her areas of specialization include the political economy of oil, commodity trading, extractive sector transparency standards, including the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, and the Nigerian oil sector. She has authored academic articles on these topics and co-edited the volume Smart Aid for African Development. Alexandra holds a PhD in international relations from the University of Cambridge, where her research addressed the political economy of oil sector policymaking in Nigeria. She spent 2008 in Nigeria as a Fulbright Fellow. Prior to joining Revenue Watch, she consulted for organizations including the World Bank, DFID, and USAID, and served as Assistant Director for the Program of African Studies at Northwestern University. Alexandra also holds degrees from University of Ghana and Emory University. Thank you. Marcelo?
Well, thank you very much. I have to say I'm very, very grateful to you, Fawzia, for inviting me here, and to the Open Society Foundations for welcoming somebody from the World Bank. I have to say, I admire the work you do here. It's not just that you give voice to the voiceless and hope to the poor. It's that you do it in a way that opens new doors for all of us. The freedom with which you think tells a story. I walked through that corridor just a few minutes ago, and some of those photographs, some of those torture chambers come from my country, my city, my times. I recognize those pictures. And frankly, if I had known 35 years ago when I was in Buenos Aires that somebody here in fancy New York was thinking of us, it would have lightened my heart. So thank you very much, and my hat off to you and to your colleagues. Let me profit from that attitude of yours, institutional attitude, to work an idea with you, to explore one idea that may or may not work for every country, but carries a lot of promise for many. And in particular, I'm going to refer to the idea of making the average African citizen share in her own natural wealth, to make Africans shareholders of their natural resources that belong to them anyway, literally to distribute a portion of the commodity rent. That's how it's called when you speak about oil, gas, and minerals. It's a commodity rent that today goes from the companies to the government. How about if we just cut a portion of it, we discuss how much, and distribute it to all the citizens? What would the impact of that be? How crazy is that? And you can think about distributing this portion of the rent uniformly, meaning we all get the money whether we are rich or poor, or we can target it. We can just say, if you are poorer, we'll give you more money. Okay? So that's the idea I want to explore with you. Before I do, let me give you some context of why this is important. I mean, it's not just the intellectual exercise of it, although that's interesting in itself. The technology to explore, exploit, and export natural resources has never been better. Actually, there has been a discrete jump in the speed, the cleanness, the efficiency, and a collapse in the cost of the technology necessary to find stuff underground. And let me explain this in visual ways. Today, in the past, you used, about 100 years ago, you sent a guy to the jungle and he dug holes until he found something. And you were not sure even then. Today, two ladies fly a plane very slowly and very low with a chain, and at the end of the chain there is a metal ball. You think I'm kidding, it's true. It's called the MAD, Magnetic Anomaly Detector. And that metal ball shoots waves down that go up to 200 meters underground and bounce off anything that it found, they find in there. And the computer up in the cockpit says, this is gold, or this is oil, or this is gas. Okay? Now, I know it sounds futuristic. In fact, this was invented during the Vietnam War to check for the Viet Cong in the jungle, but didn't work because the computer were not fast enough. Now they are, and they use it to make money, not to kill people. Now, this is not cheap. Actually, it will cost $1 billion to map the whole of Africa. And I know because the team that is trying to do precisely this works in my department at the bank. I sign their checks. We call it a $1 billion map. And they tell me, these are all engineers, they all look like Indiana Jones. You know, these people are really tough enough, not like me, they don't wear ties. But they say, our guess, ballpark, we only know 10% of the natural wealth of Africa. The other 90% is yet to be discovered. In the last 5 years, there hasn't been a single coastal African country that hasn't found something. The latest news came from Kenya, you heard the story, right? All of a sudden, Kenya is oil rich, Kenya. And moreover, it's water rich. So they're now talking about being not just oil rich, but also being a basket for the rest of the region, a food basket. So keep that in mind. What we are talking about here is not just a bonanza of prices, it's a bonanza of quantities. The fiscal rent, the money that goes to governments, depends on the prices and on the quantities. The prices, our prediction, is that they are going to stay high, but they will stop growing. This is a projection for both energy and non-energy commodities. And what you see is that they will stay up there. It's amazing how much they grew in the last decade. That's China coming to the world. That's what globalization does to you. And they will still high until at least 2025. So the prices will be high and flat, and the quantities will be expanding. So the revenue going to governments is going to be gigantic, unprecedented, for countries that didn't get this money before, not just for the ones that already did. Now, if you put that together with the past, then you say, oh my goodness, this is bad news. And there are a lot of people that speak of natural resources as a curse. My friend Alan Gell published a book 25 years ago saying, is oil a curse or a blessing? Many people say this is terrible. Why? Because the countries that in the past have shown natural resources and gotten a lot of rent out of them did very bad. Let me show you one interesting chart. The bottom line of economic development is life expectancy and child mortality. Everything else is economists like me talking. Okay? If you really want to go to the bottom of it, if a country can extend the average life of the citizen, or the life of the average citizen, and can keep children from dying in the first 5 years of life, then they are doing better or well. Okay? So look at this, no? This is interesting to this is interesting to me. This is the under 5 mortality rate and the GNI per capita. GNI per capita is the income on average for the citizens of that country. And what you see is the enormous rate of infant mortality for countries that are very rich in natural resources, no? Angola, Nigeria, Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea, for God's sake. Look at the GNI per capita of Equatorial Guinea. No? And on the other hand, you have countries that really don't have much in terms of extracted commodities, but do very well. Now, what you see for under 5 mortality, you see also for life expectancy. No? Now the countries move to the other side of the graph. Right? The life expectancy is very short for countries that have a lot of natural resources. Now, this is data for 2010. By the way, data in Africa doesn't come every year, so when you get it, you use it. But probably reflects the last 50 years. This reflects past bonanzas, meaning all those bonanzas that we saw in the past got wasted. Okay? The money went somewhere else. So if you put it together, you say, well, listen, I mean, we're going to have this new bonanza, bigger than ever before, pushed by a technological breakthrough in the last 5 years. Are we going to use it the same way as before? Are we going to do the same things? Are we going to waste it? Are we going to be here 10 years from now in another one of these seminars and say, oh man, we missed. The money's gone, as we had to say now for the previous 10 years. So that's the context, no? You will say, well, why are these countries that are so commodity rich at the same time so underdeveloped? What's wrong with them? And the literature is all over the place, but the theory that I would say has the most supporters is one that says commodities, and in particular extractive commodities, weaken your governance. On the one hand, there is more money to steal, so corruption pays off more. If you're in a country that has nothing, it can't be really corrupt, even if you want to, there's nothing. But there's a lot of easy money coming in, you know, there's something to fight for. But there is a second reason, which is deeper, and it has to do with the fact, and this is where the political scientists, and I will come back to them in a minute, where they now are having a field day of research, they say societies that do well are those where there is a fundamental contract between the citizen and the state, in which the citizen pays taxes, and in exchange the state gives public goods, things that you couldn't produce by yourself, for example, public security, a stable currency, a healthy population under 5, meaning vaccinations. Now, people stretch the concept and say public education or public health. Maybe those you could perhaps consume with your own money. But there are things that you cannot produce or consume by yourself if somebody doesn't give it to you as a group. That's called public goods. Okay? Now, so the fundamental contract says, I pay taxes, okay, and in exchange, you give me public goods. Now, when, say the political scientists, your country is commodity rich, you don't have to pay taxes. So the state grabs money and produces public goods. There is no contract with the citizen. Now, they say that if you pay taxes then you and the public goods don't come, the services are terrible, then you can go and kick the government and say, what happened to your contract? I hold you accountable. If I didn't pay taxes, you have no right to hold anybody accountable. So the theory is commodity-rich countries tend to have weaker governance, first because there is more to steal, and second is because there are fewer people checking, because they have nothing, no incentive to check. They just get free goodies. Okay. Let me also say, finally, as we enter into a process of democratization, and Africa is part of it, I would say the last 10 years, and it's very imperfect, by the way. No, you check the age of these presidents, some of them, and the tenure that they've been in, you wonder, no? But still, you know, you talk. People can speak up. No? As we get voice, we realize that there are 5 degrees of separation between the average citizen and the resource, between oil and the little kid that walks into a school, public school. What are these 5 degrees? Well, the first is a minister of energy or a minister of mining deciding who to give the contract to. the decision is taken, very sophisticated decision, nobody checks with the kid. Okay? The second degree of separation between the oil or the copper and the kid is the company itself. It is a private company or semi-public company that decides how to explore, at which speed, where to explore, how to extract. All those decisions are taken without the kid being consulted. Then there comes the Minister of Finance that puts together a budget and says all this money coming from the royalties will be used this way. No consultation with the child. Then it comes Parliament or Congress, where people debate and say this budget is not good or is good, or we are going to reload it somehow. In theory, they consulted the citizen when voting happened. That was 4 years ago. And then finally, there is a minister of a sector, say education, that decides where to build a school and how, you know, how much to pay to the teachers, which teacher to hire. They take the decisions again, no consultation with the child. And finally, somebody goes to the child and says, this school you're walking in is thanks to your oil. And he's supposed to understand that that's his oil, that he took the decision. This is bringing a new debate, this idea that you have voice and those are your resources that you need to be consulted along the way. That wasn't there before. Before, we never even thought about it. We just took technical decisions in these five steps and went for it. So that's the context. I had to say the idea of then saying, well, let's do something different, and that thing that is different will be to distribute part of this fiscal rent to the people, say a 10%, could be more. That idea is fairly new, to be very frank. No? I could say 10 years. I will show you some literature now, but the interesting part is that only two places on Earth have actually done this. One is Alaska, and the other one is Iran. I don't know if you know this, but if you live in Alaska, just for being a resident, you don't need to be born there, you will get about $1,500 a year. And that's the distribution of the rent that comes from the accumulated oil money. So they distribute the rent of the fund. They have what they call the permanent fund. They get the rent, they manage the money well, they distribute by the number of people, and you get your check. Okay? Now you will say, well, if I live in Alaska, I deserve it. Maybe. Now, 10 years after, Iran, actually 20, because the Alaska started distributing money in the mid-80s, so it must more than 30 years, Iran, very recently, a year ago, tried to do that, but for a totally different reason. The Iranians had these gigantic subsidies to gasoline. No? Gasoline was cheaper than water, very much like Venezuela, and I will come back to Venezuela. Anybody knows how much is the gallon of oil, sorry, a gallon of gasoline in Venezuela today?
4 cents.
How much?
4 cents.
4 cents. That's right. Now, it costs more money to take the gasoline to the petrol station than to actually sell it. And I didn't say that. President Chavez said that a year before he died. Now, the Iranians had the same situation, so they said, this is crazy. So what we're going to do is this. People, do you want the money into a bank account, or do you want me to send you the money through the price of gasoline? And people say, no, we prefer to have a bank account. So every Iranian got a bank account and a debit card. Okay? And the debit card went to absolutely everyone, you know, not by household, but by person. And they began to transfer the money to the accounts in exchange for raising the price of gasoline. Very progressive, because the poor don't have cars. So it worked out very well for them. Now, those are only two cases. Now, in theory, the first paper that I know of is by Javier Salamartin and Arvind Subramanian. And that's back in 2003. They proposed the same arrangement for Nigeria. And the profession really slapped them around. Profession and practitioners. People say, this is crazy. What is this? The money's not enough. It's a joke. All kind of reasons that I will go into in a minute. But they were pushed back. Huh? Following them, nobody wanted to touch the issue. So these two respected and respectable economists didn't do very well, so nobody really wanted to touch the issue. So very few papers. One of those is mine with a colleague, but not much. And most of this is very recent, as you can see. Why? Well, because it's very easy to criticize the idea. There's a long list of reasons not to do it. Okay? Let's go through those reasons. And what I'm going to claim today is that none of them holds true. That there's no reason anymore not to do it. That technological and political changes have made this a distinct possibility, something that is very practical. that could be happening anytime. Okay? Let me go through those. I know you will point timing, right? I'm glad you didn't take, so we start from now. Right. The first reason is identification is too costly. To find out who you are and how to reach you is not trivial. Okay? Now, think about it. Think about it. At least in Latin America, we know that 10% of children don't exist, meaning they are there, but they've never been registered anywhere. There's no birth certificate. So they will never be part of a contract. They will never have an ID. They will never sign up for anything. They don't exist, legally speaking. Okay? So identifying somebody irrevocably, meaning I'm sure it's you every time I see you, is not trivial. Try to do that in Africa, rural Africa. Not trivial. Well, truth is, and this is the big message, you are going to take one message with you, should be this one. We are on our way to knowing the world's poor by name, individually, one by one. We are on our way to knowing the poor by name. I will come back to this, but if there is something you want to remember from this talk is the idea that the poor are a group. Those that look in a certain way, or live in a certain place, or profess a certain faith, that's passé. Today, we know the poor individually. This started, of all places, in Mexico, 15 years ago, when the Mexican government decides to transfer cash directly to each poor person. At that moment, everyone except two people thought it was crazy. Okay? And I know because I was the lead economist for Mexico, so I was witnessing this. Even the World Bank was against. And the two people that believed in it were the director of the budget, who is now the chief economist for the Inter-American Development Bank, and the then president, President Ernesto Zedillo. Now, he believed in it because he was an academic. He was an accidental president. You remember that he became president when the candidate that was supposed to be president got shot and killed. So the two of them say, to hell with theory and economies and the World Bank, will do this. Okay? We all were against. Even the Catholic Church was against. There were jokes in the media saying that the program called Progresa at that time, today it's called Oportunidades, Progresa translated into cerveza, which means beer. Okay? People were going to drink up the money. So the discussion was about conditions. Put conditions to the transfer. Give them the money if they keep the kid in the school, or if the pregnant mother goes to the clinic and checks herself once a month. If not, don't give them the money. So it was all about conditions. Now, when you look back 15 years, we now realize we were all wrong, including the bank. Because what mattered was not the condition. Those people were going to take the kid to school anyway. Or the mother was going to check the clinic if there was a clinic. In fact, what matters is that it forced the Mexican government to meet the person, to give them the money. Because the Auditor General was not going to allow that, you know, some, you were going to give money at random. No, you need to meet the person. Moreover, you need to establish a mechanism to transfer the money. At the time, it was a pickup truck, or many pickup trucks. Literally, they would drive into a village, open a window and say, money to the right, sign to the left. And most people sign with an X. Okay? Today, it's a debit card, a cell phone transfer, it's a point of sale, it's more sophisticated. In fact, today, there are 70 countries in the developing world, 70 developing countries, of which 35 in Africa, that are already doing this. They already know the poor by name. The identification process that was so difficult, India has proven that can be done in about 1 minute for $4 per person. Somebody shines a light into your eyes like this, the information goes into a handheld device like a BlackBerry, goes up into a satellite, down into a mainframe, and you exist forever. And let me tell you, if you didn't exist before, existing is very good. Feels very nice. And this is $4. In 4 years, India identified 400 million people. People are queuing up to be identified. Of course, they do, because they know that once they are identified with this mechanism, there are all kind of benefits that go to them, social programs, voting, and so on. Kenya did the same, only in the last election. And in 3 months, they identified a third of the electorate. 3 months. And we said, man, keep going. Just identify everyone. Identification is no longer an issue. If there was a reason before, it's no longer a reason. We will soon know all the poor in the world by name. And I leave you this idea. I could speak forever. No, I love this stuff because it changed economic development fundamentally. But I leave you with this idea. President Bachelet, Chilean President Bachelet, I should say, she just took over for a second tenure. She hired as a Minister of Economy the same fellow that used to be her Director of the Budget, which in Chile is the most important person after the President. And she said to him, this is what the rumor goes, she says, by the time I leave, I want to see every child on the screen of my computer. Okay, I want to see the name, the equivalent to a social security number, all the needs and all the programs he's qualifying and he's taking, or she. Now, of course, think about it. She says child because she's a pediatrician. Okay. But the concept is very good. The British are doing the same. They speak about the citizen journey through the public sector from the time of conception to the time of death and after death, what happened to your inheritance. Okay. So identification no longer an issue. The second reason that people tell you about is if you take money away from the state, there will be fewer public goods. Remember I told you about the purpose of the state is to provide public goods, things that we cannot provide by ourselves, like policing or a stable currency or vaccinations. So people say if you take money away, there will be fewer of those. People will trade in private consumption against public goods. Okay? And that was a very strong argument, let me tell you. In fact, people translate it politically, say you will defund the government. The World Bank is proposing to defund the government. And that's when my boss actually called me to her office and gave me a piece of her mind, because she said, are you saying that? I'm going to give you the counter to that. I'm going to claim, as I claimed with my boss at that time, that sometimes, in certain cases, taking money away from the government and giving it to the people will increase the production of public goods. And I'm going to show you a little model. I know not all of you are mathematicians, but before I show you the model, I give you a 30-second example, and you will understand it forever. And it goes like this. You go home tonight, and your honey pie, your better half, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever it is, says, honey, close your eyes. And you say, no, I can't play with you. I mean, you can see with the World Bank, and it was boring, and you know, I'm tired. No games, no. Please close your eyes. So you close your eyes, she takes you, or he takes you to the garage. Okay? She turns on the light and says, now open your eyes. You open your eyes, and what you see in front of you is a brand new red Ferrari. A red Ferrari. Okay? Now, imagine this, eh? Red Ferrari, garage, she or he. Question, what would you think at that time? What comes to your mind? If you are a man, the first thing that comes to your mind is, I'm really good. She loves me. I must be really good. If you are a she, if you are this lady that receives the present, the first thing that you think is, he must have done something very bad. Right? But once you overcome this emotional side of things, what do you think? The first thing you think is, where is this money coming from? I didn't know we had that kind of money. Right? Jesus Christ, this is nice. What do you do? I mean, I didn't know you had that kind of job. Well, if I were a citizen of Venezuela, or of Nigeria, or of Iran, and all of a sudden the government says, here is 10% of our rent distributed to all of you, and it's $1,000 in my pocket, and I live on $300 a year, then I will ask the question, can you tell me what you do with the other 90%? You will begin to worry about that 90%. Moreover, the political system will take you towards, give me 15 or 20. And then the state will have to prove why not. And the national debate changes. That's called the scrutiny effect. Okay? Meaning, I give you money and I trigger you to scrutinize me as a government, as a state. And for every dollar, a government that is not scrutinized will produce fewer public goods than a government that is scrutinized. So you may have a situation, I'm going to bore you to death now, but those of you that love mathematics, behind my jargon there is serious science, by the way. Let me show you this chart. You may have a situation in which the production of public goods has what's called decreasing returns to scale. Meaning at some point the government has so much money that just putting more money in the pockets of the government will not produce more public goods. For example, would you really say that the reason why we still have problems, basic problems of child mortality in Equatorial Guinea is that the government doesn't have enough money? If we just give them more money, they will really solve it now. I don't know about that. Okay. Now, on the other hand, at the very beginning of a government, when you begin to capture some resources, you need every dollar you possibly can get. That's South Sudan. I don't know if you've been there. I mean, it's very sad what's happening there. I was there from the very beginning when they became a government, no? And there's nothing. You know, Juba is a very poor, well, Juba is the capital, so it's relatively rich, but even itself is poverty as, allow me to say, as poverty should be, meaning there's nothing. The statistics office is, for the whole country, is half the size of this room. There's nothing, there's no state. So you don't want to take the little money that they get from oil, you don't want to take it away from them. Because one extra dollar may make a difference. That's called increasing return to scale, different from decreasing return to scale. So you may have a situation in which when I take money away from you, because I scrutinize you now more, for every dollar I give you, you produce more public goods. Okay? And when you take money away from the rich state, the rich government, in fact, because of the scrutiny effect, it ends up producing more public goods. So you end up having people consuming more and the government producing more public goods. Now you will say, Jesus, that sounds like magic. How did you do that? Right? Well, because the money in between was previously stolen, to put it simple. That money was being consumed by the private sector, but it was two or three people, or a few, or the connected. Okay? Now, I know this is, I promise not to do any theories or charts or anything like that, so I won't. But keep that in mind, because the idea that there will be fewer public goods if you take money away from the government depends from which government you are taking the money away from. Now, third reason not to do it is that the politicians will never have an incentive to do this. That's why it hasn't happened. Most people that say to me, you're crazy proposing this, they say, well, keep talking about it, it's fine, but it will never happen. Okay? Why? Well, because if I'm in the government, the last thing I want to do is to give away the discretionary power of saying where the money goes. That's called the value of incumbency. You are incumbent. Okay? So if I'm now in government, why would I propose this? Now, on the other hand, if you are in the opposition and you think you can become government, you have a chance, then you also don't want to propose it because you say, the day I go in, I want to have the power. So the only ones that will propose this is a desperate opposition. Those that say, look, if we don't propose something crazy, it won't happen. And lo and behold, that's what happened in 2006 in Venezuela. The opposition proposed a program called Mi Negra. I don't know how many of you speak Spanish, but Mi Negra means my blackie, okay? But in Venezuela, it has a connotation of your lover, okay? You know, you will sound like you love, you call them Mi Negra or Mi Negro. So people were going to have a black color debit card in which the Venezuelan government was going to load part of the oil revenue that PDVSA, the oil company, the public oil company, now picks up. That was a proposal of the opposition. Of course, President Chavez, because it was a proposal of the opposition, couldn't support it. Moreover, he had no incentive to do it, so he died there. Okay? Now, on the other hand, people would say, well, so Marcy has no hope. The political system will never do it. Maybe. However, I ask you, why did the conditional cash transfer programs a la Mexico happen? There was no political reason for Mexico to do what they did, and then for 69 other countries to copy it, right? It was just one country that did it, out of a miracle. Okay, what we call a sunspot, just the sun shines there. And then it was impossible for the rest not to do it. The pressure on Brazil, on Chile, on Paraguay, on Argentina, on Uruguay, now every Latin American country has won. So our prediction is the moment we find an enlightened leader that wants to shake up things in one country, it will spread like fire. Or so we hope. Now, next thing people say not to do it, they say bad macroeconomics. And I'm a macroeconomist by training. So they say you should know better. This will cause something called the Dutch disease. I hope none of you is from Holland, but it's called the Dutch disease. What it means is people will just grab that money and run and consume it. And because the country doesn't have enough production capacity, supply response, then everything will go to imports. And that will ruin the macroeconomy. It will be a problem with the balance of payment, as it's called. Okay? Well, not so fast, Jose, not so fast. Because that assumption, that assumes that when I give the money to 10 million people in the country, they will take it all abroad by consuming. But that's different, you are saying, than what the two or three people that grab the money today do with it. Most likely those two or three park that money in Geneva anyway. So the macroeconomic flow of the money is the same. It may even be better if you give the money with the poor. I know I'm going slow here. The nationalization debate, this is another one. I don't know which side of the political spectrum you all are. I'm in New York, so I don't want to make any assumptions here. But normally, in other cities, people have right and left. Okay, and there's a big debate between the two saying who should own these natural resources, but more importantly, who should exploit them. And you will hear a lot of arguments, particularly from the left, and I hear a lot of that in Africa these days, saying it should be a public company. We should nationalize all this and run it through a public company. Civil servants, well-meaning public servants, should run this company. And there is no way to get them out of that idea. Okay? Actually, my own country just nationalized the oil company, right? Now, question. Now, by the way, this goes very well with voters in general. People like this idea, we have a national oil company. You should see Twitter when my country nationalized YPF. It was fun. I mean, everybody, you know, people from the right even say, yeah, take that, Spain, you know, we took it away from you. Go and colonialize somebody else. Anyway, it's a macho thing to do. However, question to you. If now you are a shareholder of this company, meaning you get a percentage of the profit of this company in your own pocket, okay? You have Minegra in your pocket, right? Like this. Now, will you like that company to be run by some civil servant, which is a political appointee? Or would you like some hard-nosed, rampant capitalist Indiana Jones Texan to run it for you? Now, we can have public property in both cases, maybe owned by the state and by the people in both cases, but who would you like it to be run? The nationalization debate stops the moment you make people shareholders. This idea that, take that, Spain, now it's national. If it is my own money, excuse me, wait, no, bring Exxon, or bring somebody that knows what they are doing. Okay? I'm running out of time. This one is a tricky one. Another reason why people say don't do it comes from behavioral economics. And it's a mix of psychology and economics, which is really in fashion these days. And the particular argument I'm going to make comes from the MIT, so you have to take it seriously. These people are serious. MIT, you know, when they say MIT, you just pay attention. They are always half right. But that half, they have it all the time. There is a school of thought there that says we human beings have a limited mental bandwidth. Okay? We can deal with so much and no more. Okay? I know the women here are all thinking about your husbands, right? You know, if I watch my soccer game, I cannot watch anything else. Don't talk to me when I'm watching golf. No, it's a limited bandwidth, mental bandwidth. And they say seriously, look, that's how much you can deal with. And they say poverty occupies the whole bandwidth. When you are poor, when you are hungry, when you don't know where the next meal is going to come from, everything else exists no longer. Okay, your mental bandwidth is crowded out. Okay, so in that world, if you come with your smart debit card and give people money, they will not spend more time checking what the government is doing with the other 90%. They say you are dreaming. Okay. Well, think about this, right? What you are really saying is that poverty makes you stupid. It's a huge moral claim. Now, you may be busy, but that doesn't make you stupid. Now, the way to discern who is right and who is wrong is what something called randomized control trials, RCTs, which is also another new technique of the last 10 years. In economics, we never experimented with people. That was for medicine. When I joined economics 30 years ago in Catholic University, the last thing you would propose is let's experiment with people. No? let's play games with them, see how they react. You know, they will kill me to say that. Today we do. Today we do. We do that. We show up in a village and we say, half of you will get the voucher for fertilizer, half of you won't. And then we check a year later. No? You can't really do development economics today if you are not willing to do a year in some godforsaken village and do an RCT. It's truly the rage. I don't know what it's taking us as a science, in a literary, or as a profession, but that's what everybody is doing. So when you do RCTs to see whether people are mentally blocked because the bandwidth is complete with poverty, you find both cases pro and cases against. For example, there are cases where, in Kenya, for example, we have one of our own RCTs, they cost a fortune because you have to, you know, really randomize the sample, you have to basically take over a village. We show parents how badly their kids do in the public school by showing them the tests of their kids. We film the kids taking the test. And the expectation was once they know how bad the kids do, they will go to the school and say to the teacher, hey, what are you doing? You never come to teach. I didn't know you were absent most of the time. But they will call the school accountable to the child result because they got not information. Well, we tried that, it didn't work. They didn't. So people say, you see, mental bandwidth. But then we did in Benin, and they did. Not only did they do that, they also used their own savings, very little ones, to buy tutoring for the children. So there's no evidence either way yet. How do you call the judges? No, in the trial you have a judge, the jury. Yeah, my English is not there. I'm working on it. So the jury's out on that one. Okay, I resist to believe that when you say to people, here is your 10%, because you are so busy with your day-to-day, you will not think about the other 90%. I don't buy it. At least I would like to say test it. Okay? And then the final issue is, you do this and you will weaken the efforts to build good government. Okay, the type of thing that Alessandra does, and does very well. Let's build institutions of government. If you do this, people will say, oh, well, then we don't worry about the government. Well, I don't know about that. I think it's the opposite. I think you will create a demand for good government, because the government now will have to operate with fewer resources. Now, let me take you now finally, and I'm stopping here. Okay, let's do it. No, let's assume that we give 10% of the resource rents that go to African governments away to the population. Okay? Before I tell you, I need to work one technical concept in your minds, which you will capture very quickly. It's called the average poverty depth. Average poverty depth. You see, you're poor, technically speaking, if you're daily income is below a certain level. It's called the poverty line. If you are under that level, you are poor. In the US, by the way, we have the poverty line. It was invented here by a lady in the Social Security Administration about 50 years ago. And the poverty line today in the US is about $12,000. If you make less than that a year, you are considered poor. In Nigeria, it's $460. As you can tell, it's very different to be poor in the US than in Nigeria, right? But if you are under the poverty line, from where you are to the poverty line, there is a distance, right? So if we measure the distance for every poor person under the line, all of them, and then divide by the number of poor, you get the average poverty depth. Average, because you average across, and it's the distance of all of them. How deeply into poverty the average poor is. Keep that concept, okay? Now, what we want to do is to compare this rent that we are going to distribute away to this average poverty depth. Meaning, if I give you the money, do I bring you up to the poverty line or not? How big is the money? Maybe too small, because I give you a little bit and you barely move. Okay? So what we want is to transfer money that will cover a lot of the average poverty depth, hopefully all of it. Okay? So we went out and calculated this business, and this is what we found. Whoops. This is what we found. Yes. Assume we are going to give away 10% of the rent that goes today to the governments of Africa from natural resources. 10% of the natural resource rent goes to the government, you take it away, and then there are two ways to give it out. Universally, everybody gets a piece, or only to the poor. Remember, now we know the poor by name. Okay, so you can target it. Now, what you find here is that a 10% DDP stands for direct dividend payment. A 10% will cover more than half of the average poverty depth, meaning it will be a huge impact in your life in three countries: Angola, EQG, and Gabon. EQG is Equatorial Guinea. And remember, those were the ones that we spotted in our early charts, the ones that appear to have the highest infant mortality and the lowest life expectancy. Okay? Moreover, if you say this 10%, I will only give it to the poor, then other countries come into the picture. Republic of Congo and Nigeria in particular. And Nigeria was the one on the basis of which this idea was discarded 15 years ago, when Javier Salim Martin and Arvin Subramanian put it forward. Okay? Now, you can then say, well, covering half of the average poverty debt is big. How about if we do a little poverty mitigation, meaning cover 10% of the debt or more? 10%, you know, it's a nice little push if you are poor, right? Then the list is huge. Oops, that's the list, right? Covers 10% or more, yeah. Okay, you see the list is very big. Now, put the question backwards now and say, well, hold on a minute. How about if you just cover everything people need, meaning lift everyone up to the poverty line? How expensive will that be in terms of the revenue that the governments now get? And what you see is that it's very cheap. Oops, not that one. That one. Okay? No. We didn't have to go. This technology is killing me. Here, no. That one. That's it. Okay? What you see is that in cases like Angola, Equatorial Guinea, or Gabon, if the government was to give 10% or less of what now it receives to everyone, they will end poverty. To give an idea, the average household in Equatorial Guinea will get about $6,000. And that's only giving up 10% of what the government is now getting, which is probably what gets wasted, maybe, let alone corrupted away. So it's very little. Now, what you are looking... Okay. If what you're looking for, though, is governments that are willing to give up to a third or less to do away with poverty, then the list is much longer. Then you have Angola, Botswana, Chad, and so on. Okay. Now, this is true for national poverty lines. I can do the same for something called the international poverty line, meaning the same line for every country, which, by the way, for extreme poverty is $1.25 a day. There's a billion people out there, a billion people living on $1.25 a day or less. And I urge you to imagine your life with $1.25 a day. I do this every time I go to a university and ask kids, tell me how your life will be with $1.25 a day. And they can't even conceptualize, you know. They say, well, maybe I don't drive the car so much. I say, what car are you talking about? Well, you know, maybe, you know, my internet connection will be slower. $1.25 is food. That's it. No toilet paper, no sanitary napkins, no new clothing, no new shoes. It's $1.25 a day. They cannot even conceptualize it. All right, this is true then. As you can see, it doesn't change much when you use the international poverty line. Now, we didn't stop here. I don't have time to explain it, but there is another natural resource that we probably should touch upon that you know about, that goes to Africa. And we couldn't hold ourselves. We shouldn't have done this, but we did it. And is, what about if the money, this all this money that came from oil, gas, and minerals, but there is another flow of money going to the continent that comes from donors, particularly from governments, what's called the foreign aid. Okay? So Africa gets a lot of this money. How about foreign aid? How about if we distribute foreign aid directly to the people? 10%, same thing. And what you see is then that the list gets even larger. You can then poverty or you can then poverty or eliminate poverty in even more countries. This is if you want to hit at half. This is if you want to hit at 10% of the poor, and this is the list of countries, it's amazing, the list of countries for which foreign aid is more than sufficient to end poverty in those countries. Like I know it's very small print. I will leave the paper behind so you can get it. Let me repeat this. This is a list of countries for which foreign aid is more than sufficient to end poverty. Okay? So, let me stop here. What you heard today is one chapter, one of the issues discussed in a book that I want to leave with you, which is this one. My publisher did tell me that Christmas is coming and that you should really consider this as a present. But beyond that, this is a book of ideas. I plug in there everything that sounds crazy these days in development. And what I would really love, if you ever read the book, is to send me your comments, to see how you react to it. Because we are going to solve this together. It won't be the World Bank alone. Thank you so much.
Great, thanks. I'm going to speak very briefly. It's getting towards dinner time, and it's a Monday night. But want to pull out a few ideas from Marcelo's great and very provocative conversation. I come from a political science background and think a lot about how politics work in resource-rich countries. And want to kind of bring that perspective to this discussion of cash transfers or dividend payments. I'll use either term. In the paper that Marcelo mentioned, there's some amazing statistics about how life expectancy and other metrics of well-being are worse in resource-rich Africa than they are in African countries that don't have oil, gas, and mineral resources, which is kind of a staggering thing, that the countries that have access to money to help address those public challenges aren't translating it into outcomes for the people. So what's kind of broken, and I think you hinted at it, that most of the research shows, and a number of country experiences bear this out, that when you have resource wealth in an environment with weak institutions, it leads to political and governance challenges that keep those resources from benefiting average citizens. What do those political challenges look like in practice? What you tend to see is massive centralization of power and wealth. So unlike most industries like manufacturing or agriculture, where you'll have big businesses, small businesses, they're getting some of the money, the government's getting some of the money. In the case of particularly oil, but also mining, the money and all the power gets dumped right at the center. And that has massive implications for how a public system functions. One of the symptoms is that discretionary allocations by those in charge end up determining economic success in a lot of cases. So if I'm the Nigerian president and you all own Nigerian companies, your business skills are not as important as how much I like you. And that leads to a lot of dysfunction within how different sectors work across the economy, not just in the oil or mining sector. The state becomes something to milk, to try to get as much out of as you can. Another problem is that you see accountability actors being co-opted. Parliamentarians, journalists, opposition parties. When there's that much free money at the center, the ability for the incumbent to kind of not always silence through repression, but silence through co-optation, those kinds of voices becomes extremely strong. And then you have what's essentially a zero-sum battle for power, because whoever sits in this seat gets to decide kind of how the whole system works. So these are some of the attributes that we see in a lot of resource-rich developing countries when it comes to the politics. So it's important to think through what might that mean for a policy suggestion like the one that Marcelo's making. And there's no simple answer to that. I mean, I think that this topic is hugely important. We have to, you know, there need to be ways that the latest resource boom benefits Africa in ways that the previous ones haven't. But we have to think about this politically. There are a number of economic and other kinds of technical policy solutions that have been come up with, and then they haven't worked. I won't pick on the World Bank too much, but a well-known case in Chad where the World Bank was deciding whether to provide its backing to an ExxonMobil oil project. And they said, all right, we're going to do it, but only if you set up certain institutions to safeguard the oil revenues that eventually were earned. Now, I think most people would agree, and the World Bank evaluations bear this out, that that effort at a safeguard didn't serve its function. That on paper, those institutions made a lot of sense. But if you looked at the political realities of Chad, they didn't really have a chance. That those in power had no incentives to kind of follow the rules that were set up in advance. So how can we avoid, if we do try this new kind of policy approach, how can we avoid similar outcomes? What are some of the political ideas we need to think about? And I just want to offer four very quick ideas to add some kind of political texture to the more economic and development thinking behind the cash transfers idea. The first is that one of the alleged benefits is that these transfers would create a constituency for good management of these resources, that you'd be a shareholder. That if you're a shareholder in a company, you suddenly care a lot more about how that company's being run. This is the scrutiny effect that we were talking about with the Ferrari. I was, as a New Yorker, excited about the idea of just a garage, but the Ferrari would be even nicer as well. This idea that if you're getting a share of it, you'll care about what's going on. And this is some of the writing about Alaska tends to support this idea that in Alaska, each citizen gets a portion of the earnings on the savings fund. They don't touch the principal, they get a share of the earnings. So what that means is there's been massive popular support for saving in Alaska, that the more oil revenues that are saved, the larger that dividend check is going to be. So you have the savings fund that has been politically untouchable for decades and now can help Alaska when it does need to transition away from oil revenues. So that's an example of how it can work. There's a couple concerns. One is there are some enabling factors that that allow that scrutiny to work. And sitting, I mean, I'm sure a number of you work for the Open Society Foundation, and this is like your bread and butter. Is do people have the information they need? Do they have the education levels they need to kind of participate in a public debate? Do they have the freedom to do so? Do they have the channels to access their policymakers? If you're in Saudi Arabia or Iran and your government's giving you a dividend, that's great. But the idea that you're going to scrutinize them and hold them to account depends on a lot of other kind of enabling environment factors in addition to just the fact that that transfer exists. Another concern with this idea is that do the people then become a constituency for reform and good management, or do they become a constituency for bigger and bigger cash transfers? Mongolia tried this cash transfer thing in 2008, and Mongolia has a pretty healthy democracy, and there's two main parties that compete for power like here. In the 2008 elections, kind of out of nowhere, one of the parties says, we're going to give each Mongolian a share of the forthcoming mineral wealth worth about $700. I don't know. And then the next day or in the next week or something, the other party said, we're going to give you $1,000. And this debate around how much money it was took over that electoral campaign at a time when there were so many important decisions being taken about how to manage the forthcoming copper wealth in that country. So is it a constituency for good management? Or does it kind of distract everyone from a lot of the other governance issues, and it's just about how much am I getting from the government? A second concern is around this idea that these transfers will kind of rebalance things, that all the power and influence is at the center, and one of the proponents of this called it a radical democratization of economic decision making. So rather than the state making all the decisions, now all the citizens are making the decisions. Good, this sounds positive and really helpful in resource-rich countries. But the concern here, in playing devil's advocate a bit, is what exactly are you spreading out? There's a Nigerian president who himself was unbelievably corrupt, who described politics in the country as a cake-sharing psychosis, that it's all about who gets what share of the cake. If you suddenly are transferring to every single citizen, is that what you're democratizing? Are you engaging every single person in this kind of quest to get a little bit bigger piece of the cake? That kind of rentier discussion that dominates the public space in so many resource-rich countries, there's a risk of that being exacerbated. Again, no idea whether that would happen. I'm sure it would vary from country to country, but it's worth thinking about. The third idea is, again, one of the merits of cash transfers, is this idea, and this is how it was described by another scholar, is preempting kleptocracy. So rather, if you have a system, a government system that is, you know, is corrupt, and money goes into it and then gets siphoned off through all kinds of channels, you try to build a road, you give a big contract, the road never gets built, etc. Forget it, just give money to the people instead. Now that's promising. I think there's a enough like libertarian in me that this idea of let people decide what's best for them and don't make it all up to the bureaucrats. And in some countries, I do a lot of work in Nigeria. If you talked about it being nicknamed beer there in Mexico, mm-hmm. like someone could throw a party for themselves with the money, and that would probably be more useful than what some of the Niger Delta governments are going to use it for. I mean, the bar is not very high that you'd have to pass in order to spend the money better than how the government is spending it. But the concern here is that those benefits are highest in the places where implementation would be more difficult. So if you have a government that's so corrupt that it can't be trusted to spend this money, that's the same government that's going to have to run this cash transfer system. And I agree that a lot of the implementation tasks around identification are, I don't think, major barriers. But would there be enough trust in the system to even get the money out to the citizens? So I'm going to, one more thing before I finish, and this is this idea of taxation, and I was glad you brought it up. Some of the people who've proposed cash transfers say, you should actually not transfer 10%, you should transfer 100% of the oil and mining revenues to the people and then tax back about 90%. So it's kind of artificially creating this idea of taxation. So the government will still rely on oil revenues, but it's kind of creating this psychological effect that like it does become more of the citizens' money. And the idea is that the government would the people would pay more attention to how the money's being used. The government would have to defend why they want 90% back and not 95 or 85%. That would kind of stimulate some of the positive accountability effects that are associated with normal income tax, or sales tax, the kind of broad-based taxes that we pay. And this is, I think, a fascinating experiment. But the concerns here is that, why would a government do that, especially an oil-rich government? Taxing your population is really hard. And if you can get money from other sources, you're not going to voluntarily do it. It's very politically costly. It's expensive. You have to set up kind of quite elaborate bureaucracies to do it. So if I'm a government deciding whether to kind of get an oil-backed loan from China or to tax my population, I'm going to choose the easy route every time. So this idea that you could kind of pair transfers with this like simulated taxation idea, I think is fascinating on paper, and I think that it reflects some really interesting dynamics. I'm not sure I could imagine a political situation in which a government would actually choose to do it at a level that would be meaningful. So those are a little bit random, sporadic thoughts on some of the political issues around whether this would actually help. I'm going to stop here, give Marcelo a couple minutes just to kind of come back on this, but quickly, because I want to make sure we get chance for questions and answers from the audience.
Well, let me say, Alessandra, thank you very much. I don't have to come back because okay. I'm with you here, meaning I agree on all these things. I mean, I think you're hitting it right on the nail. This is the debate. Starting by the very last point you say, there are people, actually one person, that is saying, give it all out and tax it back. And by definition, you will be taxing more from the rich than from the poor. That one person that is a pioneer of this is my co-author, Shanta Devarajan. And him and I have our discussions and almost intellectual fights because I don't believe that's possible. If you go that way, you are basically kicking the ball off the field, which in soccer is legal, but it's very anticlimactic. Because what's going to happen here, you give it away, and people will say, well, until you set up an administrative system to tax income, not consumption, it's going to take you forever, in Africa in particular. So I'm with you on that one. Shanta, however, says, look, this is the only way you will alter the political equilibrium, which takes us to your first point, which is, this is a very political thing. Yeah, hell it is, yeah, sure. And the whole idea is that we, the technicians, came up finally with one idea that can alter the political equilibrium. Normally, political equilibria of the low level get altered, and there is a chapter in the book about this, by one of the following things, or altogether. One is a crisis. It took a crisis for politicians to do something or pretend to do something about global financial supervision. Okay? An enlightened leader. Once in a while, one person comes that enlightens everyone and things change, sometimes for the worse. Okay? A technological breakthrough. You know, today we think fighter pilots are cool. In 20 years, we'll think they are so passé because everything will be drones. Okay? So, change. And then finally, the one that is there is cultural change. People caring for new things. Now, when I started in economics, we never spoke about environmental sustainability. Now, you don't even think about the project without saying, is it green enough? Something changed about what we care. A collection of things that you care about is called a culture, your values. Okay? So I agree with you, we have to shock the system, but I tend to believe that this is the one shock that may alter the game. And what you said, that the next person will come and say, I want 50%, and then I give you $1,000, I give you $3,000, this is a good thing. Because that means somebody is caring about what people think. And I leave you with this concept. I was coming here and I was checking my emails. One of my colleagues working in the Middle East, I used to work in the Middle East, I used to live in Egypt, in Cairo, and work for Lebanon during the reconstruction. It was a great time. I can barely recognize it now. I mean, there was a revolution, a change. No? And he said in the email, tell them that this idea will be fantastic for the Arab world. And he gives me a list. It will be the one thing that will unite all Iraqis. Because only if you are a real Iraqi with an Iraqi passport, you will get a transfer. No? So no more Kurds, Shia, Sunni, everybody will be Iraqi, at least on that. Okay? Then he says, and tell them that in the Gulf countries, and I have no evidence of this, this is what this fellow says, they already do this, but instead of doing it in cash, they do it in jobs. You get a de facto job for life in the public sector if you don't have one. Okay, this is no different from my direct dividend payments. It's just that one is a job, the other one is cash. I prefer the cash because at least then you do something that you really like. Anyway, let me stop there.
Okay, great. Let's take two or three questions from the audience. One here, and then one over here, and then the third, please.
Oh, okay. For me, it seems to me...
Can you give me your name at the beginning so I tell you?
My name is Angel with Wings.
Okay.
Seems to me if a natural resource-rich country, the natural resource technically really belong to the people. So when you transfer the cash, whatever they transfer, it should be transferred. Why is it only concentrated to small group of people? However, if a different story, let's say it's a manufacturing country, bunch of people work very hard, then the rest, another group doesn't work at all, every day sleep, for example. Then if you transfer the money, then it doesn't sound fair because they worked very hard, they doesn't. But in a resource-rich country, the resource belongs to them.
Please.
Yes, a quick note and then an actual question. A few years ago, upstairs actually, or no, maybe it was at the old OSI, James Hansen gave a lecture about climate change where he proposed as a means to control hydrocarbons usage, gas usage and hydrocarbon emissions, that the American government raised the price, arbitrarily raised the price of gasoline, and then return equal amount to every citizen in America, as an aside. The actual question that I have is, has to do with, everyone knows that China is on a rampage of purchasing commodities from oil, gas, gold, every possible mineral that you can think of, and minerals that we've never even thought of yet. How can governments who negotiate contracts, long-term contracts today, deal with this type implement this type of procedures if there are really no, at present, international laws that govern predatory pricing, mm-hmm. every other possible concept that one can come up with. That's it.
Sure.
There was someone here. Yes, sir.
Yeah, my name is Roberto. I think I wanted for you to discuss two things. One, there are a number of African sovereign wealth funds, so that's an alternative to what you're talking. And the question I have is, I have two questions. One, I really would like to see the numbers, because the numbers of dollars or whatever to transfer to the number of people, like in Nigeria, you're talking like close to 200 million people, you know, whatever, how much it would actually impact. But more importantly, you're talking about fluctuating commodities. So today they get $1,000, say. Mm-hmm. Next year they might get only $100. And then, you know, and the whole, there's a whole issue that they're not working for it. So, you know, what they may have an entitlement issue, and it's also not promoting any real economic good by working or doing something.
Sure.
So those are three things.
Start with those three, and then...
Do you
want
to touch on one?
You
don't have to?
Sure, go ahead.
Sure. Okay. Hi, my name is Jipsy, and I was just... I wanted to ask about data, because, I mean, you brought up yourself the fact that there is very old or late or unreliable data to begin with. We know there's a huge lack of transparency in the contracts in the first place, contracts that get renegotiated partially or for part of the time, or et cetera, et cetera. All of these issues that are governance issues really around being able to devise a system that would have to be run by these governments, you know, how are they actually going to carry this out in a transparent manner that would go hand in hand with the accountability that you say this program would actually incentivize? And the other is, on the issue of national identity, would this not also incentivize the marginalization of certain groups whose citizenship is denied or taken away on the basis of this kind of benefit?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Let me first confess, I don't have any answers for any of these questions. I'm not going to even pretend that I have, which is a good part of it, really. This is the time of debate and poking, intellectual pushing and pulling, really. This is what we should be doing. But let me work with you, build on your ideas. No? When you say the resources belong to the people, that's the whole thing. That's exactly right. I think Andrew really hit it on the nail. That's the thing. It's not property of the government.
Yes.
At the most, I'm willing to entertain a discussion that is property of the state. You know, here the word state gets confusing in the U.S. because provinces here I call a state, but anywhere else, a state is the apparatus that exists independently of the president in charge, basically, to put it in my plain vanilla way. Well, at the most, we discuss that, but it belongs to the people. Now, you may say, well, the constitutional order of each country will dictate who owns it. For example, is every Mexican entitled to the same share of ownership, even though all the oil is in Tabasco? Okay? I mean, then you can have a problem, because people say, look, I mean, I want to break off and, you know, get my own country here, because, you know, we got the money here. I don't want to distribute to those guys there, right? Well, yeah, sure, this is part of the debate. I totally agree. But once we say we are a country built on many nations, under one contract called the Constitution, then the system works. If you haven't solved that issue yet, if you're still not sure who is who and who belongs and doesn't belong, and you still say, well, we had 3 million foreigners here, even though they've been here for six generations, then I don't think you can do this. So you can identify physically, but you know, I may, you know, how many countries do we have with second-class citizens? Or non, you know, citizens which are, by definition, disenfranchised. And some of these countries are pretty advanced countries. It's not just, no? You're pointing to the U.S. I don't know. But I'm sure there are, no? I mean, there are many countries where this has not been defined yet. So I wouldn't push my technology of, yeah, we identify you, as saying, yes, you belong. Those are two different concepts. I agree with you. Now, the issue of the, yeah, this idea of not having a legal framework for many of the, how can I put this, for many of the inputs into the proposed technique, issues like predatory pricing, or even the transparency of the contracting with the exploiting companies. No, how do we know? How do we know that the company is really passing on all its profits or the corresponding part? You know, the books are always murky, because the ones that are drilling are they. I visit these sites when I travel, even though I'm a macroeconomist, I get invited. No, I just was in Tamatav in Madagascar, where the nickel terminal is. Okay. And it's like a city, gigantic, okay? And there is a giant pipe that comes from about 100 miles away, where slush comes in. No? You see the pipe going over the mountains. And then the pipe gets into this city. And the whole thing boils to one spot, where this engineer took me and says, here is where we make money. And I said, what do you mean? Look. And then there is these giant bags that hold up to 3 tons of nickel pellets. So all of a sudden you see this pipe and the nickels fall, boom, 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 and each one of these pellets is like a $10 thing in the market. So they actually, as he says, we make money here, not in the profit sense, but the actual sense. No? Now, if those guys all of a sudden move the pipe somewhere else or take some money away, and there's no way for the citizen to ever find out. I don't know what it, you know, the supervisory mechanism I saw there was just the company itself, because there was nobody from the state there. As it should be. So I agree with you. However, all that happens whether you distribute the fiscal rent to the people or you keep it with the government.
That wasn't really my question.
Okay.
The question was that if I negotiate a contract today, a long-term contract today, and there are no international legal systems to renegotiate that contract later on an international basis, what is there to say that contract that I negotiated today, it can be revoked?
Sure.
Or that the company that negotiated that contract is, sure, now using that contract in a predatory,
sure,
fashion.
Sure.
That's the point. Obviously, corruption,
sure,
is going to exist regardless of what system you're involved in.
I completely agree. And it works both ways. No? The company can cheat or the government can cheat. The next politician comes,
yes,
to town and breaks the contract.
But internationally,
we don't have the mechanism.
Nationally, there's antitrust laws, there's all kinds, mm-hmm, of laws, anti-corruption laws, but internationally,
no, we don't.
There is nothing.
And, what we have, we barely enforce, because we don't have the mechanism,
exactly,
to enforce it. But that's also true for many international laws. You know? I mean, how do you enforce? It's very difficult.
The
I mean, these days, when we look at what's happening in Spain, no? I mean, you, just, oof, you wonder. No? But I agree. I think you have a point there. Roberto was mentioning the sovereign wealth funds. Isn't this a better option? You know what the sovereign wealth fund is, where the government says, of all this rent that I get, I will save some, okay? And we will see it grow. And we will use that for maybe the next generation or for emergency cases. If you want to see the best system of anywhere in the developing world for sovereign wealth fund management, you look at Chile, okay? Your boss party is very proud of that. It's just an amazing thing. I envy these guys. You know, we Argentinians are on the other side of the Cordillera, the mountain range, but we might as well be on the other side of the planet, because it's so incredible. Now, there are commissions where people are called on to predict the price of copper. Okay, so 16 people are hired every year, and you want to be part because you want to, and then you have to guess the number for the average price of copper in the next year. And then they publish all this, they drop the top and the bottom, average the other 14, and that's the price with which they build the budget in the government. And then the fund itself is used under certain circumstances only. So the there is a very good chart that you might want to look at, the popularity of the Minister of Finance during, actually before, during, and after the 2008 and 2009 crisis. Okay, Andrés Velasco. The poor fellow was the most unpopular person in the country because he kept accumulating. And people said, no, come on, let go, give us some money. No? And then 2008, 2009 comes, the condition of the disbursement happens because the economy tanks and the price of copper tanks. So he said, now is the time to use the money. And he starts putting money into the budget out of the fund. And his popularity jumps. It's an amazing thing. But it's only one country. I don't know many that have managed sovereign wealth funds that well in the developing world. That's a big question. That's a question for Alexandria and her colleagues. No? Alexandria and her colleagues. And then finally, the issue of data. I have a paper on this that is in draft. We just submitted it to the Center for Global Development Working Paper Series and for the Journal of African Economies, which is more scientific. I'm happy to leave a copy with you, Fauci, if you want to distribute it. The paper at the back, which is very unusual for papers of scientific standard, the paper has the raw data, because the data is so difficult to find. You know, you're absolutely right. Data in Africa is gold. So it took us a good year and a lot of young people chasing data country by country. And what we said is just let's put the data at the back. That data will show, that table or those tables will show you also how much money we are talking about. And you're right, when you just make the plain division in Nigeria, you say, well, this is $30 only. What about that? $1 a day and doesn't make a difference. Well, I'm not sure it doesn't make a difference because the poverty line in Nigeria is also very low. Moreover, the latest household survey which just came out, the poverty line is even lower, meaning there are a lot of poor people in Nigeria living with almost nothing. So if you give them $30, you really make a huge difference for them, even though to us says, oh, come on, that's a joke. It's $2 a month. What do you want to do with that? So I think that's a part of the debate. What this paper is trying to do is to bring the actual data and say, look, here is how much people will get. Yes, in Equatorial Guinea, it's $750 per person.
That basically, you're declaring that poverty line that's totally arbitrary. I mean, the idea would not be to go toward the poverty line. The idea would be to go towards some sort of relatively decent standard of living, not by general standards, not to go to a poverty line. You can declare the poverty line at a level that it's, I mean, here we say $12,000 is a poverty line. If in New York City, if you live with $12,000, you die basically. You can't even, you know, you freeze during the winter. I mean, so, but I mean, and you didn't talk about the variability of these things because prices of commodities move. That's where the sovereign wealth fund has a mechanism to show, to transfer in bad times and to accumulate in good times. But if you give somebody a $30 this year and next year you say, oh, sorry, we don't have any, you're going to get into trouble again.
Well, but
in this country and in country where you and I come from, there are a number of people who have long left this world who still vote, and that is, in your example, may still get an allocation, because one of the problems is in accountability is, you know, people who are long dead still get pensions and stuff like that. So I don't know how you would do that.
You can find holes, implementation holes of all sorts. You know, what you're referring to, it's not just pensioners. It's teachers as well. You know, we always say when countries, you know, countries come to us when they have problems, and they say, well, one of the problems is that we cannot sustain this fiscal deficit. And if you have any clue, can you tell us without saying it too loud, any quick fix? And when they look at me, and my quick fix, which I never say too loud, is audit the teachers, the teacher roster. And I guarantee you 10% of the teachers are dead. And they still get their money, their salary, but they're all dead. And sure enough, what they normally do is they say all teachers have to resign again. In physical presence, they have to show up to some place, and they save a ton of money because many of them are dead. So yes, this will happen. This, whether you do it with the sovereign wealth fund, whether you do it with pensions, whether you do it with public sector salaries, but it's an implementation issue. It's not in the concept. Yes, if you have that problem, you don't want to touch it. On the other hand, the sovereign wealth fund, if you can make it work, a la Chile. Yeah, sure, you may not need this. Sure. But how many countries do we know whose politics has supported the sovereign wealth fund a la Chile in the developing world? I know only two. Chile and Malaysia, developing.
Nigeria started a sovereign wealth fund.
So that would be a good practice.
Not yet.
You could wait for a while.
Anyway, did I answer? I mean, I'll touch on them at least, right? Yeah, okay. Let's get more questions.
Good. Let's take maybe two or three more. Yes, sir. Start us off.
Well, just to add to the long list of reasons why this is probably not going to ever work in Nigeria, I spent the weekend with a woman from the Niger Delta, runs a women's resource center, and as I was listening to the discussion, we actually had a discussion yesterday about this meeting, and she was sort of saying that while the idea of a cash transfer to people in the Niger Delta, in the communities, would actually be very popular and would have a good impact, it would also remove any last remaining vestigial possibility of cleaning up the grotesque environmental devastation in that area. Because everybody would have a personal interest in maximizing the production of that oil and a corresponding interest in keeping their costs low, mm-hmm. which is the reason why the place got in the mess it is now. So she was sort of saying, yeah, it would be nice to have the money. You couldn't even increase the transfers to people in those communities because there will never be enough individual money going into individual pockets to actually clean up the mess. We've got a tab for that now, courtesy of the UN, $1 billion, but 30 years to even make a dent in it, and that's just in Ogoni land, one little piece of it. So I think that's what she would say. I was intrigued by your $1 billion map. Have you guys actually written that check? No.
Yeah, the project is going. You don't write the $1 billion check. I was just doing you go slow, no? You go pieces by pieces, but the projects are going, yeah. And I can put you in touch with the people that are doing the things. Can I answer just this one on Nigeria? Nigeria has been and is still the battleground for this idea, you know, because that's where the first paper came up. And the now Minister of Finance was Minister of Finance then, and she said, over my dead body, no way. She's a good friend of mine, so I can say these things. And she was used to be in the bank. So she would say, no, it's too little money. I travel a lot in Nigeria, and I also attest to what your friend said about the environmental degradation that the oil industry has brought there. Although it's getting better. Moreover, remember, many of this is informal oil production, if you may call it, because a lot of siphoning off the pipes and the pipelines. Having said that, that happens whether you do cash transfers or you take the money to the government. You're right that in theory there will be less money to do the cleanup if you distributed the money alone. But I was sure the cleanup is going to happen. And that's where the public good issue comes, no? Is it an issue of they don't have enough money? If they just have more money, will do it cleaner. That's my issue. But I can see, in Nigeria is a very hot point. The state of rivers, they are now debating to do it because they have most of their social programs are identified, meaning the beneficiaries are actually known by name. Pregnant women get a cell phone and they get a call on the cell phone if they are supposed to check themselves, or if they feel contractions, they call that phone. It's a government-provided cell phone. The schools have also cell phones. When the teacher doesn't show up to teach, dial 1. If the teacher came to teach but is drunk, dial 2, and so on. So they had the beginning of a basis to do this, and I think it's a question of time, really. I don't know exactly how it's going to operate because Nigeria is federal. The money goes to the federal government, not to the state, but going to be a great case to study.
Can you talk about the program in Mexico and what's working with that and what's not working? Because I'm having a hard time grappling this, the benefit of this idea. So if you can kind of talk about Mexico and what's, you know, and if there's anything unique to Mexico that makes it work there that other countries wouldn't necessarily have.
Yeah, you alluded to some health indicators that were correlated with economic development. I personally believe that the health of a country actually determines the economic health, and the social determinants include poverty, gender-based violence, as well as education. And I work in health, but it's really determined by health policy. As Alexandra pointed out, what's required is political will, good governance, and stewardship. Now, I never heard anybody address how you're going to generate political will. And as you know from one of the international meetings some years ago, the countries agreed that they were going to spend 0.7% of the national output, their budgets, on health.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, that reality was not met except for a couple of countries. And the reason for that is they depend upon donors like USAID, DFID, CETA, to create a health system. Now, these systems in the developing countries are either broken or non-existent. And women, who are the key, really, to be empowered and to develop the economics of the country, are totally neglected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of their patriarchal societies. And the question that I have, really, is how you're going to make these institutions change. I mean, how are you going to develop functioning healthcare systems? I know from Uganda, when this gentleman brought up the fact about oil and agreements being canceled, that's exactly what happened in Uganda. They just totally nixed it because they knew that they weren't getting a fair share. Now, what I wanted to say about health systems, if they started a conditional transfer of money, a voucher for the woman to come in for antenatal visits. In other words, the woman would not get the voucher until she came.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the idea of giving women cell phones was not really that useful because they lost cell phones. The husband or partner would steal them from them. So we have certain mechanisms in place, but implementation, political will, good stewardship, good governance. How are you going to make that happen?
Good. I'm going to take advantage of sitting up here now and throw one more in
sure.
in terms of questions.
One
of the things that jumped out of your presentation was this idea that, you know, when it really comes down to it, life expectancy, child mortality, these are the results that we should really be looking at. But then your research is mostly about getting people above the poverty line. And this speaks to your point a little bit, that it's, you know, it's a line, it's a useful demarcation of people who are, you know, have it really tough and distinguishing them from people who have it a little bit less tough. If you give a transfer that lifts someone's income above the poverty line, is there any way to then assess whether that will affect those outcome indicators mm-hmm. around life expectancy and child mortality and those kinds of things? I assume it would vary from country to country,
mm-hmm.
that in some countries the constraints people are facing is the money in their pocket, whereas others it might be that the schools and hospitals and security system around them is so deplorable that they could double their income and still their lives would be equally challenging. So whether that can be factored in at all into what you're looking at. Hand it over to you again.
I mean, this is the problem with speaking to smart people. They ask smart questions. Let me again build on them, because I don't really have the answer. On the Mexico case, but in all these so-called conditional cash transfers that then became just cash transfers, of which this is a broader case, because this is just, remember, the cash transfer is decided by the government. The government decides out of the blue, I'll give you this much. No? So the politician that is in office says this much. And it's not linked to any natural resource, even though it may be actually paid by them, because, you know, Mexico got, for many years now, less oil revenue. So who knows? Money is fungible. Maybe they are actually paying that, but it's not linked in the mind of the people. Now, these conditional cash transfer programs have been now evaluated to death. And there's a very good book by Marito Garcia, I think Ariel Fishbein, Norbert Shadi, and one more colleague that is free. By the way, there are so many free books now hanging in the internet. And it has an evaluation of all the programs, basically. All the evaluations that are out there is what they call a meta-analysis, right? Which they sat with all the evaluations available, say these are good evaluations, scientifically solid, what is the outcome? And by and large, the result is they work. They work. So we're all happy saying they work. Until last year, the father of all this, that director of the budget that I mentioned to you in Mexico, he came up with a book called Good Intentions, Bad Outcomes. I remember I called him and said, what are you doing? You just ruined my idea. And he says, well, many of the things that we tried to do may not have happened as much as we thought they had happened. We may have distorted decision making. Maybe that some people actually were anyway going to take the kids to school, and by us giving them money, the only thing we did is just pay for, I don't know, cerveza, beer. Or maybe well, the only thing we at the margin produce is now a government that was forced to provide the clinic, otherwise the mother couldn't meet the condition, so the supply response. So even the father of these CCTs, as they are called, conditional cash transfers, is beginning to have some doubt. And he has a book out there. I'm not sure it's free, but he has a book out there. However, on the whole, the evaluation of the 70 programs that I know of, which are in this book, which is free, is a positive one. Now, let me jump from your question to your question. What does it mean, is a positive one? I mean, I bring you up to the poverty line, and what? No? This is a deep question. What is poverty? And I remember my editor for the book said, oh, you have to put a definition of what poverty really means in your book, no? In the first page. And it took me more to write that one page than the whole book. Because there are libraries written on what poverty really is. Just to give you one example, I worked many years, I was country director for the Andean countries, all the way from Bolivia to Venezuela. And when I got to Bolivia, there was this big change of government from non-indigenous to indigenous. All of a sudden, my counterparts were all indigenous people. And they challenged everything we said. You, World Bank, know nothing. And we said, well, but here's a poverty analysis, and we kept going and going, and we never came to any common ground. Until I understood that the definition of poverty was different. You know, in Aymara, the word for poverty is huacho, which essentially, literally means somebody lonely, somebody orphan, somebody is not accepted by the others. You are poor in the Aymara culture if you are not part of a community. Whether you are a millionaire or you don't have a coin, it's irrelevant for them. Because the property anyway, which is the land, the pacha, is owned by everybody. So their concept of poverty has nothing to do with $1.25 a day or $3 a day, nothing. Now, go completely on the other side. No? We have countries now that are trying to define poverty in a more holistic way. And they're not talking about poverty, they're talking about happiness. So Bhutan has a happiness index, okay, which is a good attempt. And by the way, there's a lot of mathematics behind this thing. It's not just somebody giving an opinion. No? All very true. But we need to find some common ground to say this is poverty as we understand it. Most countries will say if you consume less than a third of the average citizen, then you are poor. Okay, that's how you come up with this poverty line. That's how it's defined. It's not just a number that somebody picks. So that's how the US came up with this idea. A third of the average consumption, by the way, here, no? It's $12,000 a year. Now, when you compare across countries, you need some common number. And that common number today for extreme poverty is $1.25 a day. By the way, dollar is a word which is very difficult to define. We call it PPP dollars, purchasing power parity dollars. It's not just a dollar in your pocket. Very complex stuff, because you have to compare the same price in two different nations and then to one or more nations. No? It's very arbitrary. But there's no better solution. And if you are under the poverty line, you know. That's my big take. You know, I remember saying to the indigenous people, you know, fine, I buy your story, you have to be in a community. But do you like the thing that you don't have money, and you go to the market, you don't make enough, or the prices went up and inflation is killing you? No, no, that's terrible, that's terrible. And then you need a macroeconomist. So I think we need some common understanding, at least one, to measure these things. But I agree with you, just giving people money and saying you are on the poverty line, now you're happy, is silly. In Latin America, now the poverty line, the common poverty line that we use is $4, not two. And we say from 4 to 10, you are not middle class, you are vulnerable. The new concept is vulnerability, meaning any time you can fall under the $4 a day. Very quickly, the issue of health, I couldn't agree more with you. One economist that I respect a lot, Larry Summers, is going around saying, he did some calculation. This is the beauty of Larry, you know, he comes up with this, he used to be my boss at the World Bank, but he comes up with this new concept, you know, out of the blue, and he says, when you look at growth in the developing world, he comes up with this calculation, I think it's a third of the growth is due to better health outcomes. So, in a way, he's in your camp. Health precedes income. No? I never seen a disentangling of this, except for what Larry's trying to do, and it's very difficult to disentangle, because you don't have enough data to control for this. No? Now, the other thing is, there is enough evidence, although it's always RCTs, punctual evidence, that if you are very, very poor, you don't invest that much in health. So it works both ways. My very, very boss, the new president of the World Bank for the last 2 years, Jim Kim, his entry point in development was to help fight multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. So he started in Peru, in the outskirts of Lima. And, you know, he went to this neighborhood, which I used to be because I was a country director as well, and very soon he realized this is not just about drugs. This is about the income of these people. You know, the reason why they live, you know, in the way they do is because they don't have clean water, you know, it's very humid, they have dirt floors, and so he got a concept of health that it was more holistic, because he was facing the same issue that you're raising. Let me stop there. I think I covered the four of them. Yes, I think.
Any last burning questions from the audience? One here, and then I think that's it. And then one in the back row. Last two, then we'll wrap up. Go ahead, sir.
Well, it was just my follow-up question about the map, because I'm still intrigued by the billion-dollar map. You're certainly right about hydrocarbon exploration all up and down Africa, now on both sides of the continent, in fact, east and west. And I think that that's probably what your map would facilitate, was the identification of yet more reserves, in addition to the minerals that would be there. But we already know from the climate scientists that we can only conceivably burn about a fifth of the reserves we've got now. Mm. And so we're just we're creating a carbon bubble in the markets, because these companies, with now the World Bank's billion-dollar map to help, will be spending an awful lot of money developing reserves, which is how they're capitalized, that they can't burn. So I guess my rhetorical question about that is, wouldn't it have been a better idea to write that billion-dollar check to clean up Ogoni land?
To clean up?
To clean up Ogoni land.
I see.
Yeah.
My question is much shorter. You talked about also giving part of foreign aid to the people, which has a very nice, you know, feeling to it. But isn't most foreign aid at the end of the day tied and goes back to the country that's the donor?
Okay. Shall I take this too? And let me offer to you and to others that are interested, if you send me your email, maybe by Twitter, I put you in touch with the task manager of this program. He's a very senior person, of course, with a lot of money. And he can give you the latest paper. This is the very beginning, because they are just doing it in a few countries to demonstrate and then do to other countries. But the beauty of this is the following. Once you find out what is in there, you find out with certainty. I mean, there is no this asymmetric information, differential information between you and the explorer company, which tends to be the tricky part, because the government doesn't really know how much is in there. No? And the explorer said, no, I couldn't find anything. Well, I'll take it, I'll drink here, but it's nothing. But they had incentive to hide. That's one thing. And the second is, if you socialize the information, if you say, yes, this country has all this, because it's technically proven, then the balance sheet of the country improves, and the credit rating of the country improves, and all kind of other financial measurements will improve. And everybody is better off, because information was socialized. That's the idea of the map, and that's what we are part of. They don't really need our money, apart from the coordination across countries. But let me put you in touch with these people, and you judge by yourself. Now, on the foreign aid, I completely agree with you. It was just such an easy target, no? Because we had to go through the budgets of all these countries. And in the budgets, you see the oil, but then, you know, what we call below the line, after the deficit, it comes the financing items. And you always find foreign aid, no? A concessional, non-concessional grants. So we say, come on, let's repeat this with the foreign aid part. And sure, the foreign aid works as well or better than resource rent. And some countries, very honestly, have no resources but a lot of foreign aid. So it was an easy score, honestly. Now, whether the foreign aid, once it gets distributed as cash, does not anymore fulfill the objective of the donor. Maybe some donor is thinking, oh, I'll give this money as a way to prop up my contractors. No, I say, I give you government, I give you this money to build that road, but you have to hire companies from my country. So it's a way to subsidize my company, not really to help in the recipient country. So yes, they may not agree then to monetize the foreign aid. But what we were after was the dimension of it. And frankly, there is enough foreign aid to go around vis-a-vis the poverty lines, no question about it. Let me just leave you with one concept, and it's this. Whether it's this particular idea or any other, I want to repeat the message that the book carries, and it's this. Development and the poverty reduction that goes with it has never been more possible for more countries. Never. I've been in this business for now almost 30 years, and I've never seen it so possible. When I go to colleges and universities, I say to the kids, if you ever wanted to get into this business, now is the time. So the work that people like you and the foundation do couldn't be at a better time. So thank you all very much for coming. Thank you.
Thank you very much.